This morning, we are going on in our look at David and heart matters. David, as a person, is epic. If he was on YouTube, he would be viral. And yet David struggled with life as we struggle with life. And through all of what David went through, God was shaping his heart. God was molding him, teaching David how to live life with God at the heart level. And what we've been looking at as we have been looking at David has been what it means for us to live life at the heart level with God, at the core of who we are, to have a heart after God's own heart. And last Sunday, we looked at probably what is the most famous battle in the Old Testament, maybe one of the most famous battles of all time, a battle that was not fought between armies, but was fought between two individuals, and that was the battle of David and Goliath, right? A battle of good versus evil, the little shepherd boy against the big bad giant. It was a test of the latest in modern warfare versus a kid with five rocks and a sling. Ultimately, a stunning victory, a battle in which David experienced victory because of God. The battle is whose? The Lord's, right? God's. And that's where we left David last Sunday. David takes Goliath's armor. He keeps it as a souvenir, a memorial of God's victory. David cuts off Goliath's head and heads off to Jerusalem, pun intended, for what becomes a huge victory parade. David is on the top of his game. It's like winning American Idol and getting voted onto the island all at the same time. It's kind of like Steve Jobs saying, "Here, you can have my shares of Apple. No problem." The people are saying that Saul has slain his thousands, David is 10,000s. So whatever Saul is, David is greater. Wherever David goes, whatever David does, he prospers. God just keeps pouring on the blessings onto David. And for killing Goliath, Saul gives David great riches. He gives David his daughter Michal as a wife. Jonathan, Saul's son, takes David under his wing, kind of like a younger brother, and looks out for him. He protects him. He loves on him. David's part of the royal family. And along with that, David is the anointed king in waiting. At some point, God is going to hand over to him this entire kingdom. So we need to hold on to that picture. David is living in obedience to God. He is the model of humility, of dependability, of integrity, a man after God's own heart, that God has blessed and is blessing. In a very short span of time, period of time, David goes from being this young teenage boy that even his own family didn't think much of. In that short period of time, he goes from being a young teenage boy into being the hero of the nation, the people's champion. David has everything going his way. And that's when the wheels fall off of the chariot. If you would join me, 1 Samuel chapter 19, verse 8. 1 Samuel 19, verse 8. Anyone here ever use crutches? Okay? Wonderful experience, right? What is the purpose of a crutch? Something to lean on, support, kind of, right? Stability. Takes the pressure off, right? Kind of takes the weight off of something that's broken or sprained. A crutch is something that we lean on for support. We're okay with that? What we're going to be looking at this morning is God, when David has everything going his way, God takes the crutches out from under David. There are five of these. The first comes in 1 Samuel 19, starting at verse 8. And that is the crutch of a position. Let's say that together. The crutch of a position. 1 Samuel 19, verse 8. When there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter so that they fled before him. David, now he's an officer in Saul's army, and he's commanding men going into battle, which means that in this role, David, he goes out, he fights the Philistines, and once again, David is victorious. God blesses him with victory. It means that David has this enviable position in the king's court. He's got job security, he's got a bright future, he's got perks, he's got bonuses, a good retirement plan. Verse 9. Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. And David was playing the harp with his hand. Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence so that he struck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. Picture that scene in your mind. Maybe that's a stretch, unless maybe somebody's tried to impale you with a spear recently. Saul was tormented by this evil spirit, and he's become raving mad. And David had been chosen along the way. David had been chosen to play the harp, to come and play the harp for Saul, which calmed Saul down. But it seems like as time was passing and David was getting more and more successful, and Saul is all about who? Saul, right? And Saul is not doing well with these comparisons between him and David. So there's this pressure, this huge pressure that's building up here. So here's David. He's just come back from this battle. He's been victorious. God has blessed him. And now he's doing what he can to soothe Saul playing the harp, when all of a sudden this spear comes flying past his head and sticks into the wall, right? Right? How do you respond to that? Now, David he's a hardened warrior. He could have taken Saul out, but Saul is the king. So David flees for his life. He escapes into the night, a means of survival while he's protecting Saul. And what David leaves behind is his position. The proven commander, the faithful warrior, the harp player for the king, and a flash of the spear flying through the air into the wall. It's all gone. Never again is David going to have that kind of position of service for Saul. The second crutch that God removes is the crutch of a wife. Okay, let's say that together. The crutch of a wife. The prize for killing Goliath was who? Michael, right? Saul's daughter. So David gets the princess and they live happily ever after. Loving couple. Not really. Some background we need here. If we back up to 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 21, we read that when Michael and David got married, we're going to get married, Saul thought that was a good idea. Here's why. Verse 21, and Saul thought, I will give her to him that she may become a snare to him, and the hand of the Philistines may be against him. We read in chapter 18 that Saul uses his daughter as a pawn, because Saul is all about Saul, right? And so Saul is jealous of David, who's now upstaged him. So Saul uses his daughter as a way to get to David. And so Saul asks David for a dowry. He says, well, go out and kill 100 Philistines. Saul thinking that David is going to get killed in the process of all that. But David, blessed by God, David comes back having killed the Philistines. And so Saul now really goes off the rails and becomes even more afraid of David, more desirous of killing him, which is leading to that spear flying through the air thing that happened while David was playing the harp and David escaping into the night, which is where we pick it up. 1 Samuel 19, pick this up. 1 Samuel 19 at verse 11. 19:11. Then, after David's escaped into the night, Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow, you will be put to death. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. Down at verse 17, Saul confronts Michal. Why have you betrayed me like this? Why did you let my enemy escape? Michael's response, I had to. He threatened to kill me. What goes around comes around. Like father, like daughter. There's a certain duplicity in what she's saying here. Michal is protecting her own life at the expense of her husband's. Michael's answer works against David. It only angers Saul more. It only deepens his resolve to kill David. Point being that David's wife is deliberately sending David away, but she's protecting her life at his expense. And reading down through history, after all this goes down, David and Michal, they never again have this marriage they're living in harmony together. And so God removes another crutch. The wife is history. Crutch number three is the crutch of a mentor. Let's say that together. The crutch of a mentor. David's on the run. 1 Samuel 19, verse 18. Now David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed at Naoth. Where does David run? To Samuel, right? The man who anointed him with oil. Samuel is tight with God. Samuel anointed David as the next king. Samuel is the guy. If there's anyone that can make sense out of all this, it's got to be Samuel. And Ramah is where Samuel was from. It's his hometown. It's his base of operations. Ramah is about 10 miles north of Jerusalem. David finds Samuel in Ramah. When he gets there, Samuel says, let's go to Naoth. Naoth is about 5 miles north of Ramah, farther north than that. You know, I Googled Naoth. Do you know that there is a Chilean death fusion band named Naoth that has a Facebook page? 79 people like it. The name Naoth, it means dwellings. It was a place that Samuel had established a college for prophets. So there were a lot of dwellings there. They were kind of like condominiums. They're all stacked on top of each other, and it was kind of like a maze in the way they were all laid out. So the plan is that they can go there, and Samuel can hide David in this maze of buildings, and they'll probably never find him. However, as soon as they get there, if they get to Naoth, someone tells Saul, David is at Naoth in Ramah. So once again, David is on the run. This time it's away from Samuel. The bottom line is that the crutch number three, Samuel, gets removed. So we're together on what's happening here. Gradually, David is losing everything in his life that he could have looked to for support. His position, wife, now Samuel. Crutch number four is the crutch of a friend. Okay, let's say that together. The crutch of a friend. Chapter 20, verse 1. Then David fled from Naoth and Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, what have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? Do you hear David's heart? Do you hear the emotion in that? What did I do? Why is he doing this? Give me something to go on here, right? Saul is dogging his steps. David's living on the edge of death. One wrong move and he's toast. Slowly, David is starting to lose emotional stability. He's starting to feel the pressure here. And wouldn't any of us start to feel a little bit out of sorts with this? Right? A little pressure? If we saw our world coming apart slowly at the seams, saw ourselves starting to slide over the edge and there's nothing to hold on to as we're getting closer and going over? Maybe some of you are there now. Verse 2. He, Jonathan, said to him, far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me, so why should my father hide this thing from me? It's not so. Daddy, Saul, tells me everything. He hasn't said anything about hunting you down and killing you. Verse 3. Yet David vowed again, saying, your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight. We're best buds. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. Telling Jonathan I'm planning to kill his best friend might upset David. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death. The bottom line is that Saul wants David dead. And after some back and forth, if you read through the rest of chapter 20, after some back and forth, Jonathan and David, they come to this realization of what that's going to mean for them. And if Jonathan sticks with David, Jonathan's life is going to be in danger too. And in fact, later on, if you read down chapter 20, Saul actually tries to kill his son, Jonathan, because Saul thinks that Jonathan does have this friendship with David. At the end of chapter 20, there's a scene where Jonathan is shooting arrows. Remember that? He's shooting arrows a little farther away each time. He's telling his servant, go a little farther with this thing. Remember that? Jonathan is signaling David that David's life is hanging by a thread. David needs to run. You got to flee. Verse 42, look at how all this comes down. 1 Samuel 20, verse 42. Jonathan said to David, go in safety. Inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord will be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever. And then he arose and departed while Jonathan went into the city. Bottom line, Jonathan goes into the city. David goes back on the run. Position, life, mentor, friend, gone. And then skip with me down to 1 Samuel 21. 1 Samuel 21, verse 10. The last crutch is the crutch of self-respect. Okay, let's say that together. The crutch of self-respect. 1 Samuel 21, verse 10. Then David arose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. Remember who was from Gath? Goliath. Big dude with armor, smelled really bad. Lost his head over a small stone between the eyes. Imagine this. David flees to Gath, home of Goliath, capital of the Philistines, seat of government, the White House, headquarters of those nasty Philistine guys. David, the killer of Goliath, public enemy number one of the Philistines, David shows up in Gath looking for the king. Think that was conspicuous, just a tad? It's like Osama bin Laden showing up at the doorsteps of the White House looking for asylum. How do you respond to that? The man who killed their champion shows up deliberately walking into enemy headquarters. Verse 11. But the servants of Achish said to him, to the king, "Is this not David the king of the land? Did they not sing of this one as they danced, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s?" Great question. What is he doing here? David's response, verse 12. And David took these words to heart, the threat on his life that's behind this question. And David greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. So he disguised his sanity before them and acted insanely in their hands and scribbled on the doors of the gate and let his saliva run down onto his beard. Okay, remember David, he's got chutzpah, but he's not stupid, right? Okay, this is an act, right? But imagine the scene. David, anointed king of Israel, champion over the Philistine champion Goliath, slayer of 10,000s, drooling at the mouth, spittle running down his beard, writing senseless graffiti on the city gates, looking like a madman. How low can you go? Verse 14. Then Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see the man behaving as a madman. Why do you bring him to me? Do I lack madman that you have brought this one to act the madman in my presence? Shall this one come into my house?" You know, I got enough nuts here. I got more nuts here than a squirrel prepping for winter. I don't need another one. Okay, get rid of him. Even David's enemies toss him out. He lost his position, his wife, his mentor, his friend, his self-respect. In a very short period of time, David goes from the top of his game, the pinnacle of success, to rock bottom. You ever been there? Empty, alone, depressed, fearful, angry. You know, there may be centuries between us and David, but there is a ton here we can relate to. David trying to come grips with where he has landed, where he has crash landed. And do you see the crutches in this? What David could be leaning on rather than God? And God teaching David at the heart level, "David, you don't need all that. What you need is me." And when we're kids, we learn to lean on our parents. School, we lean on our teachers, maybe our education, maybe we earn a degree. We lean on our job or our position or our spouse or a friend or some goal we might set for ourselves. We lean on the myth of financial security. We lean on what we do for God or a pastor or some person that we admire. We lean on drugs or medicine or food, or alcohol, or having stuff, or sex, or some other kind of addiction. Crutches are what we lean on rather than leaning on God. And when we lean on crutches rather than leaning on God, our hearts are crippled. Our faith remains weak. We never gain the strength that we need to live life with God in the abundance of the way that He's created us to live life. Now, I'd like to recommend a book to you. Chuck Swindoll has written a really good book about David, the title of which is David, A Man of Passion and Destiny. David, A Man of Passion and Destiny. I'd like to read for you a part of what Chuck Swindoll writes about this part of David's life. And he calls this three warnings to all who prefer crutches. Okay, three warnings to all who prefer crutches. The first is this: crutches become substitutes for God. Deuteronomy 33:27 says, "The eternal God is a dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. Only God is to be our strength. In the final analysis, we are to lean only on His everlasting arms." Isaiah 41:10 says, "Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." I will hold you up, God says. But as long as you lean on someone else, you can't lean on me. As long as you lean on some other thing, you won't lean on me. They become substitutes for me so that you are not being upheld by my hand. Second, crutches keep our focus horizontal When you lean on another person or another thing, your focus is sideways, not vertical. You find yourself constantly looking to that other person or relying on that thing, that nice secure bank account that's in the vault. Those things keep our focus horizontal. Human crutches paralyze the walk of faith. Third, crutches offer only temporary relief. I sound like an ad for headache medicine, says Swindoll. But that's actually what we do. We turn to some remedy that will soothe us or comfort us or dull our pain. People take billions of tablets and capsules each year to find a tranquilizing experience in order to endure the storms of life. Now, I'm not against medicine or accepting help when it's necessary. I'm saying when we fall back on those as a regular habit rather than on the Lord, that's when the problem intensifies. Listen to this. God doesn't give temporary relief. He offers a permanent solution. When God created the world, when He created us, God created within us a place that was just for Him. Our hearts were made for God, to worship God, to know God, to live relationally with God. God at the center of our lives brings peace, brings stability, a settledness, life as it was created to be lived. And God put Adam and Eve in the garden in Eden, and He blessed them with the awesomeness of this world. Outside of the heart that was created for God, outside, externally, is the goodness of what God created. The awesomeness of this world, the beauty, the variety, the bounty of the world, what man is to rule over, gifts from God for us to enjoy. Sin distorts all that. The gifts take the place of God. When God is forced out by our selfishness, by our self-will, when the gifts take on a greater place in our heart than our Creator, when God is replaced, when the things take over, we lose our peace. Ugly things, attitudes, behaviors take over. Our relationship with God is severely, critically damaged. Our hearts, our lives become crippled. And what is hard is that we are so immersed in sin that we rarely realize how our sin has led us to lean on so much in our lives other than leaning on God. Just think about what we think about as ours or mine, what we covet and cannot do without, what we struggle to let go of. Even if we're told, even if we know that these things are killing us, it is amazing how necessary these things, these crutches, seem to be. Are we together on this? We would rather cling to the gift than cling to God. To lean on the crutch rather than the Creator. That's where our sin takes us. That's killing us. A.W. Tozer, writing in The Pursuit of God, another book that's worth reading, The Pursuit of God. Tozer writes a chapter entitled The Blessedness of Possessing Nothing, which is his discussion of our clinging to things, leaning on crutches rather than God, and the difficulty of letting go of all of that. Tozer writes this, quote, "The ancient curse will not go out painlessly. The tough old miser within us will not lie down and die in obedience to our command. He must be torn out of our heart like a plant from the soil. He must be extracted in agony and blood like a tooth from the jaw. He must be expelled from our soul by violence as Christ expelled the money changers from the temple. And we shall need to steel ourselves against this piteous begging and to recognize it as springing out of self-pity, one of the most reprehensible sins of the human heart." You see, we need God to remove our crutches. Do you remember C.S. Lewis's Voyage of the Dawn Treader? How many of you saw the movie? How many of you read the book? Literary crowd. Good. Do you remember when Eustace becomes a dragon? Remember this? As a result of this pure self-centered pig-headedness, call it sin, Eustace becomes a dragon. Remember that? Okay. At one point, Eustace begins peeling off these layers of scale of dragon skin, stepping out of his skin over and over again. And no matter how many layers of skin that Eustace strips off, there's always another layer underneath. It's like our efforts of letting go, or our efforts at letting go of what we're leaning on. Okay, let's face it. I mean, we generally are pretty attached to our skin. Left on our own, we only go so far. Generally, people hesitate to peel off their own skin. Aslan, the lion, who represents Jesus, Aslan tells Eustace this, quote, "You will have to let me undress you." And as Eustace tells what happens, Eustace says this, "The very first tear he made was so deep, I thought it had gone right into my heart. When he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. When he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done it myself the other three times, only it hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass. Then he caught hold of me. I didn't like that much, for I was very tender underneath now that I had no skin on. And he threw me into the water, and it smarted like anything, but only for a moment. And that it became perfectly, after that it became perfectly delicious. As soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all the pain had gone from my arm. And then I saw why. I turned into a boy again." Let me share two truths that we can use in our lives today. Stay with me on these, all right? Here's the first one. There's nothing wrong with leaning if ultimately we're leaning on God. We all lean on someone. God gives us each other to lean on. We're created for community. Husbands and wives need to learn to lean on each other. We are created for community. The body of Christ is interdependent. We need everyone doing what each of us has been called to do in order for us to do what God has called us to do. It's natural for us to lean on someone. But we need to make sure that who we're leaning on isn't taking the place of God. That we're not leaning on some crutch that's crippling our heart. We need to make sure that what we're ultimately leaning on, who we're ultimately leaning on, is God. That we're leaning on the giver of the gifts, not the gifts. Which brings us to the second truth. Being stripped of all substitutes is hugely painful, but it's also hugely freeing. Maybe you've been through a time when God has stripped away a crutch. Maybe you're going through that right now. And it hurts. It isn't easy. Sometimes that involves a period of pain and instability. When God shows us what we're leaning on rather than leaning on Him, and the pain of having our skin stripped off, the pain of having the truth of our hearts exposed, we have a choice. We can look around and try to find some other thing or someone else, some other person to lean on, or we can lean on God. God alone. Leaning on God heals the crippled heart, gives us strength for life, frees us to be who God has created us to be. Tozer concludes his chapter on the blessedness of possessing nothing with a prayer. And I'd like to have us conclude with that prayer this morning. If you would, bow with me in prayer. As I share this prayer with you, see if this prayer might be echoing what's coming from your heart this morning. If it is, you might even repeat these words between you and God. Maybe this is something you would like to speak to Him today. Father, I want to know You. But my cowardly heart fears to give up its toys. I cannot part with them without inward bleeding. And I do not try to hide from You the terror of the parting. I come trembling, but I do come. Please root from my heart all those things which I have cherished so long and which have become a very part of my living self, so that You may enter and dwell there without rival. then shall you have the place of your feet glorious. Then shall my heart have no need of the sun to shine in it, for you will be the light of it, and there will be no light there. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.